nor the Iberian Peninsula was stable enough to allow it to bear fruit. I packed my things and headed off to Asia, eventually coming back to Europe with Khan's hordes. Since then, I had from time to time toyed with the idea of starting a small Druidic grove somewhere. But the threat of Angus Og on the one hand, and persecution by monotheists on the other, always made that an idle daydream. Perhaps now it would not be so far-fetched, though, if I was able to survive the Morrigan's divination. My deal with her wasn't a universal get-out-of-death-free card. It applied only to the Morrigan, who had first dibs on my life, and that was grand, no doubt. But death gods are a staple of every pantheon, and if Angus Og was truly making an alliance of some kind with Hell, then death would come for me on a pale horse, according to Revelation 6:8. The part of her divination that truly bothered me was the heather wand, which suggested that the soon-to-be-dead warrior would be surprised before he bit the dust. I didn't think Angus could do much to surprise me at this point, but that coven of witches certainly could. They had already surprised me several times, first with the runaround about making Angus impotent, then lying to my face about their alliance with him, and even giving me their leader's blood with confidence that they could either steal it back or that I would never use it against them. And all of that was accomplished by only three of the witches in their coven. What would they surprise me with when the whole lot of them focused on me? And now here, in Rulabula, in Granuaile's head, was another witch who claimed she could take on the whole Polish coven by herself, provided she had a certain ruby necklace, which obviously was a potent magical item, or none of the cool witches would want to kill one another for it. Did I want to let someone that powerful off the leash? Granuaile stopped in front of me and leaned over to get my attention before I could answer the question. "Okay, Atticus, I'm going to let Laksha come out. Play nice." She grinned impishly at me, and then her head lolled to one side as she relinquished control. When her head came back up, her expression was inscrutable, though a sense of old age was conveyed by a tightening around the eyes and mouth. Her accented voice greeted me with clipped consonants and vowels and the lilting intonation of Tamil speakers. "I have been looking forward to our conversation, Druid," she said. "I am Laksha Kulasakaran. Greeting to you in peace." The transformation from a young, sunny Irish-American girl to an ancient Indian witch was absolutely creepy, no matter how many words of peace came flowing out of Granuaile's mouth. It gave me what Samuel Clemens used to call a shivering case of the Phantods. Chapter 20. "I hope we remain at peace," I said to the witch in Granuaile's head. "Why don't you tell me how you came to be talking to me here?"
"I was born in 1277 in Madurai during the reign of the Pandian king Maravaramban Kulasekaran, whose name I honor by taking it myself," Laksha said. "I met Marco Polo when I was 16, and through him realized how large the world must be to contain people like him in it. I married a Brahmin and played the dutiful wife while he was at home. While he was away, I played with the demon kingdom. I saw no other way for a woman in a caste system to free herself from that system. The things I have learned are mostly horrible. Rakshasas have nothing delightful to share. The trick of transferring one spirit from place to place I learned from a Vetala. You have heard of them?"
"Yes," I replied. "Vedic demons. They possess corpses."
"Precisely. I use the same principle to transfer my spirit into a gem or into a person."
"Can you transfer it into anything?" Laksha seemed surprised by the question.
"I suppose. The spirit can fit almost anywhere. But why would you want to put it into something that could be broken, or something that is of small worth? Gems tend to endure."
"All right. Tell me how you wound up on the ocean floor inside a ruby." Laksha shrugged Granuaile's shoulders.
"I wanted a new life, a new world. I decided to leave India. In 1850 I bought passage on a clipper ship that ran opium to China. Once there, the owners of this ship, called the Frolic, wanted to capitalize on the gold rush in California. So they loaded the ship in China with expensive silks, rugs, and other luxuries that would be sold in San Francisco and insured it heavily. This was an opportunity I could not pass up. America was much newer than China. A place where a woman could own a business if she chose. And so I bought passage there too, bribing the captain with promises of sexual favors to keep my name off the list. He was unimaginative in bed and smelled awful. Perhaps he sensed my dissatisfaction, for when the ship ran into some rocks off the coast of what is now Mendocino, and the hull began to fill with water, he did not take me in his lifeboat. Everyone got into lifeboats, but I was sharing a boat with Chinese crewmen who had no loyalty to me and did not speak any language I knew. And on the water, without the time and space for ritual, I am not powerful. As we were making our way to shore, with four of the men rowing, I saw that the men were looking at my necklace and talking about me. They were probably thinking that I could simply disappear, a victim of the shipwreck, and no one would be the wiser. They probably planned to sell the necklace in San Francisco and split the money between them. Whatever their plan was, one of them suddenly drew a knife behind me and plunged it into my back, while another tried to tear the necklace from my throat. In tremendous pain and trying to get away from the knife, I stood up abruptly and pitched myself overboard, taking the would-be thief with me, still fighting for the necklace. I could feel myself dying, and I could not swim anyway. Luckily, neither could my assailant. He succeeded in pulling the necklace from my throat, but not from my hands, and soon he gave up in a panic and left me to thrash his way to the surface, where his crewmates would rescue him. With my vision fading and not trusting the Vetala's methods in water, I had to choose between leaving this world or sending my spirit into the stone through direct contact. Obviously, I chose the latter, and now here I am. She did not finish her story with a smile. She simply stopped and waited for my reaction. All right, what are your goals now? To get my necklace back and then get a new body. Right, let's take those one at a time. Why is it important to get the necklace back? We can go to the jewelry store and buy you a ruby right now if that's what you want.
No. That particular necklace is a magical focus crafted by a demon. It amplifies my powers.
Does your necklace not serve the same purpose for you?
She pointed a finger at it and tilted her head quizzically. It wasn't made by a demon, but yes, it serves a similar function. I replied, trying my best to sound nonchalant. All this time, my scary witch-o-meter had been traveling further and further into the red. The phrase, crafted by a demon, sent it all the way over to the right so that the arrow was pointing only a degree or two above the x-axis. But I asked myself, why stop there? Let's ask her a really scary question. Tell me about getting a new body. How do you propose to do that?
In the past, I just took them, but now I adhere to a higher moral standard.
Took them? I beg your pardon, did you mean live ones or dead ones?
Whatever was available and attractive at the time.
So the body at the bottom of the sea, that wasn't the body you were born with?
Of course not. I am not knowing of a way to make bodies last for hundreds of years.
Of course not. I smiled and shook my head. Stupid question, sorry. The dial on the scary witchometer was now maxed out. If I told her I had figured out how to make my body last thousands of years with a special tea blend, would she eat my brain? Had she heard me tell Granuel about my knowledge of Ermit's herb lore? But forgive my ignorance on this issue. When you took a living body, what happened to the soul that was in it at the time?
This is the question that has puzzled humanity for centuries.
You mean you killed them?
I allowed them to move on in the cycle of birth and rebirth.
I struggled to contain my disgust at her actions and her callous rationale for them. I don't think I was entirely successful. I saw the beginnings of a frown on her face as she registered how I was taking it. How do you know they moved on? I asked. If you shove their souls out of their bodies rather than allowing them to die, they may still be wandering the earth as unhoused spirits.
That may be true. And believe me, I now know it was terribly wrong of me. I have had plenty of time to dwell on my actions over the past 160 years, and I saw how I preyed on innocent people as I was preyed upon by those Chinese sailors. It was karma coming back to me, and I know it was only a fraction of the atonement I must make for my centuries of sin.
Would you say that your time in the ruby was a large fraction of the atonement you need to make, or do you still have a long way to go? Laksha raised Granuel's eyebrows in surprise and then frowned at the question.
I think you are doubting my good intentions,
she said. Given the very brief history you've shared with me, I think I'm taking it remarkably well. You've achieved a kind of immortality through some really evil body-snatching process, and you consort with demons.
Consort?
Laksha looked aggrieved at that accusation. Really evil body-snatching she was okay with, apparently. But then I remembered that Flitish had accused me of consorting with vampires not so long ago, and my reaction was similar to Laksha's. That's what I hate about the Vedic concept of karma. Once somebody starts talking about it, I start noticing it. All right, I take it back, I said, waving my hands in frustration. I didn't want to get sidetracked here. That word has too much baggage, and I shouldn't have used it, because I hate it too. My point is that your acquaintance with demons and evil magic makes it difficult for me to trust you now, and somewhat reluctant to help you. I hope you will forgive my frankness, but I prefer speaking plainly. Laksha gave a tight grin and nodded her head once.
I respect that very much. I too prefer to speak plainly. So let me make something very clear. I could have taken Granuel's body forcibly, as I used to do in days past. It would have been easier to do it that way. And if I wanted to, I could leave her at any time and jump into the body of anyone on the street or anyone sitting at the bar. But I do not wish to behave that way any longer. And that is why I asked her permission to share her body for a time, and she agreed. That is why I am trying to get my necklace back through cooperation and mutual benefit, rather than aggressive and selfish means. I am trying now to enrich the world with my gifts, rather than spread chaos and ruin.
Truly? And what will happen to Radomiwa if I help you?
Karma. It happens to everyone eventually.
I let that one slide. How will you find another body to live in?
Granuel has suggested to me that we visit a hospital where there are people deep in comas, or in persistent vegetative states. Bodies that are still alive but whose spirits have already left them. Perhaps I can make use of them, reawaken the brain to a functional level. I have learned much about brains over the years.
My cell phone beeped at me and I silenced it. And what if these bodies have spirits still tethered to them, however tenuously?
I would ask those spirits if they wanted my help to return to consciousness. There will be many who wish for that. I will help them if I can, then return to Granuel and try again. Eventually I will find one without a spirit or one that wishes to pass on. Then I may occupy that body without further staining my soul.
So the immediate future for you works like this. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I agree to take on Granuel as an apprentice and help you make karma happen to Radomiwa. Then, necklace in hand, you go to a hospital and find a new body to inhabit. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, it doesn't seem to me that I'm getting much out of this scenario.
I am ridding you of Radomiwa. She is a thorn in your side, yes?
But she's also a thorn in yours. Counting something you want to do for yourself as something you're doing for me is an accounting trick decidedly skewed in your favor.
All right, she grinned. I will concede that. What do you want?
You see this sword I have strapped to my back? It's a very powerful magical item.
Is it? I had not noticed. May I see it?
I carefully pulled the scabbard over my head and laid it down on the bar. I withdrew the hilt just enough to show a handbreadth of steel. Laksha studied it, Granuel's eyebrows furrowing, and after a moment looked up at me quizzically.
There is a spell on this that will prevent it from being removed from your person, but otherwise it appears to be a normal sword to me.
That was pretty good. She could not only sense my bindings, but also determine their intent. Precisely. That is because Radomiwa has placed a magical cloak on it. I want you to remove it if you can. I could remove it at any time with my tears, or so Radomiwa claimed, but I didn't really trust her word anymore. And I wanted to see what Laksha could do. Those last three words guaranteed she would do it if she could. She didn't want to admit that Radomiwa was a better witch than she was.
Ah, now I know what to look for. Just a minute.
She bent to study the sword again, stretched out a hand toward the hilt, then stopped and looked up.
May I?
I nodded, and she continued. She lifted up the hilt from the bar and peered closely at the base of it. That evidently was not enough. She closed her eyes and then drew it toward her forehead, resting it there for about 5 seconds. Then the mask of concentration broke and she smiled, placing the hilt back on the bar.
Magical cloaks have to be fastened to the object, just like a normal cloak must be fastened about one's neck. The most logical place to do that on a sword would be at the base of the hilt, and that is what she has done. She did a very good job. The cloak overlaps and there is almost no magical leakage at all. What did you have to pay her for such a service?
Well, I went to Mendocino to fetch her a certain necklace. Laksha threw Granuaile's head back and laughed. It was not a reassuring one.
You gave her my necklace in exchange for this cloak? I think she got the better of you in that bargain.
Well, she's going to get her karma soon, isn't she?
Laksha nodded. Yes, she will.
Can you remove her cloak?
Yes. It is the work of 10 minutes.
Excellent. There is one more small service I shall require of you to feel myself duly compensated in our exchange of favors. The amused countenance of Granuaile's face turned suddenly businesslike.
One more. Name it.
When this is over, when you have your necklace back and a new body to live in, you will live east of the Mississippi and never enter Arizona again without informing me first. She narrowed Granuaile's eyes at me.
May I ask why?
Certainly, I said. I have a healthy respect for your abilities, Laksha Kulasekaran, and I applaud your resolution to live cleanly and even do good works from this day forth. I especially appreciate the consideration you have shown to Granuaile to this point, and to me. But in the unlikely event you should again traffic with demons, I would prefer that it be someone else's problem, far, far away. She regarded me steadily, and I thought briefly it was going to become an ancient geezer staring contest. But she dropped her eyes and nodded before it could be construed as a challenge.
Done, she said. Contact Granuaile when you wish to dispel this cloak. It will require some preparation and some privacy. Contact her also when it is time to go after Raromiwa.
I will, thank you. Granuaile's head lolled to the side as if she were chronically narcoleptic, and then it bobbed back up again with the native owner's personality back in charge.
Hi, Atticus, she said, beaming. Need another drink yet?
I looked at my glass, still half full, and quickly downed it.
Yep, I said, plopping the glass down a bit sloppily.
Good to have you back. I missed you. I took a deep breath and exhaled as the whiskey did its work, burning the tension away. She filled me up again and told me she'd be back after another round of visits to the rest of her customers. I never got to enjoy that last whiskey, because that's when Gunnar Magnusson, alpha male of the Tempe Pack, came barging into Rulabula with most of his werewolves behind him, including Dr. Snorri Yodersen.
"Where's Hal?"
he snarled at me.
"He left almost an hour ago," I said.
"Something's wrong," Magnusson said. "Have you checked your phone lately?"
"No," I admitted, then remembered it beeping at me in the middle of my conversation with Laksha. I pulled it out of my pocket and checked the display. It was from Emily, the youngest of the sisters of the three Auroras. The text read,
"I have your lawyer and your little dog, too. Bring the sword to me or they both die. Emily."
It had been a long time since I'd felt any desire to truly inflict pain upon another person. I tend to take the long view on dealing with irritating people, as in I'm going to outlive whoever irritates me, so the problem will eventually go away. I had privately changed "this too shall pass" into "you too shall die," and it helped me avoid all sorts of conflict. I can honestly say I had not felt such anger thrumming in my bones since World War II, but that text managed to bring all the old rage rushing back. She dognaps my friend, holds him for ransom, and makes Wizard of Oz jokes? Gods below, I hate witches.
Chapter 21. I showed the text to Magnusson, unable to summon anything coherent to say. He grunted at the message and passed the phone back to me. I could see the other werewolves bristle as he communicated the message to them through their mental link.
"Will you call her for me, please?"
Magnusson said, struggling mightily to control his anger.
"And discover where they're holding Hal. He was unconscious for a time, and now he's awake, but they have him blindfolded and he cannot say where he is."
"Absolutely," I said. "Please remain quiet during the call so she'll not know you're listening." Werewolves would have no trouble hearing everything she said.
Magnuson confined himself to a curt nod, and I punched in the number indicated from the text.
"It took you long enough," Emily purred at me after a single ring. "Maybe your dog doesn't mean as much to you as we thought."
"Prove to me he's still alive," I ground out. "I will not talk to you any further without that."
"I will have your lawyer confirm it," she said. "Hold on."
There was a pause, some rustling and snarling, and then I heard Emily telling Hal to tell me he was okay.
"Atticus," he gasped at me, strain evident in his voice. "I see half the coven in the woods somewhere."
There was a thud and a snarl, and I heard Emily in the distance shouting at him to just tell me the dog was fine, nothing more.
"We're tied up to trees. Silver chains. Oberon is unharmed so far."
"That's enough," Emily yelled.
She returned the phone to her mouth, and I heard a couple of whines from Oberon. He was still alive.
"In the eastern Superstition Mountains, take the Haunted Canyon Trail to Tony Cabin," she said. "On some maps it's called Tony Ranch, same thing. Come alone, after dark. Bring the sword. We'll bring the dog and the wolf."
"If either of them is harmed, I will bring the sword into contact with your neck, and damn the consequences." My voice rasped into the phone. "Do you understand me, witch? You are bound to me by your own blood. If you kill them, you can be sure that I, along with Hal's pack, will hunt you down. You have no idea what is coming after you now."
"Don't I? I suppose I will just have to ask my friend Angus Ogg. I'm sure he'll let me know what manner of worm you are."
"Ask yourself this, witch. If I am a worm to him, why hasn't he crushed me in the last 2,000 years? And why does he feel the need to ally himself with your coven if I am so easily dealt with?"
2,000 years? Emily said.
2,000 years?
Magnuson said. "Whoops. This is why I don't like to get angry. It makes you reveal things you would rather keep secret. Still, I couldn't let Emily know that she had scored any kind of coup by getting a fairly accurate estimate of my age, so I used it as a hammer. "That's right, lassie, you're completely fucked. The only chance you have of surviving this night is bringing me my friends healthy and happy." I hung up before she could reply.
"You're not going out there alone,"
Magnuson said immediately. He had, of course, heard every word. "I was rather counting on you to come along," I replied.
"They've put the sack back over his head," Magnuson said. "But we saw 6 witches through the link before they did. Your hound is with them, and Hal smelled someone else there too, but didn't see who it was."
"What did it smell like?" Magnuson's eyes rolled up as he recalled it and put words to it.
"Oak and bear fur and wet feathers. Some kind of bird."
"That would be a swan," I said. "It's one of Angus Ogg's animal forms."
"Who is this Angus Ogg?"
"Long story," I said. "The short version is this. He's a god, and he'll have some demons with him on top of the witches. I'll tell you more on the drive out there. Bottom line is we're in for one hell of a scrap. But we might be able to bring along someone they're not expecting."
"Who?"
I turned my head to find the red-headed siren pulling a pint of Guinness for an older gentleman down the bar. "Granuel," I called as I pulled out my wallet to pay the bill. "I will accept you as my apprentice if you will have me as your master. Do you still wish to become an initiate?"
"Very much."
She nodded and grinned at me as she placed the pint in front of the customer. "Then tell your manager you quit, effective immediately," I said. "I will be your employer from now on. We need to leave now, though, so make it quick." Her eyes flicked to the werewolves standing around behind me, crowded into the foyer of the pub.
"Something's happened, hasn't it?"
"Yes, it has, and we need your friend right away," I said, tapping the side of my head to make it clear I was speaking of Lakshya. "This is both her chance and yours, but we have to go now."
"Okay,"
she said, beaming as she jogged back to the kitchen entrance to slap open the swinging door.
"Hey, Liam, I quit."
Then she vaulted herself onto the bar, swung her legs around, and hopped off between a couple of stools.
"Atta girl,"
an elderly gentleman said, raising his pint in salute. We left the place en masse before Liam, whoever he was, could properly register that he had just lost a damn fine bartender. A lot of us piled into various souped-up werewolf cars parked across from the light rail station, and then we drove south on Mill to University. We took a right, and from there took a left on Roosevelt, winding up in front of the widow's house. I promptly set them all, except Granuel and Gunner, to trimming the widow's grapefruit tree and weeding her flower bed. Since the Tempe police were still staking out my house, and I had a pack of werewolves on the verge of going all hairy, it seemed like the best way to keep my promise to the widow and keep the pack walking around on two legs. While the widow was happily occupied admiring impossibly fit men and women grooming her landscape, I retired to the backyard with Gunner and Granuelle. "Please have Laksha remove the cloak on this now," I said to Granuelle as I placed Fragara in her hands and dispelled the binding that kept it close to me. "And you," I said to Gunner, "make sure she doesn't take off with my sword." Granuelle's eyes bugged.
"You think Laksha would do that?"
"No," I said, "but I've been wrong before, and I'm just paranoid, okay?" The alpha male scowled at me.
"Where are you going?"
"I'm going to get something out of my house," I said. "I'll probably be back in less than 10 minutes. If I'm not, send someone to check." Magnuson nodded, and I began stripping off my clothes.
What are you doing?"
Granuelle asked uncertainly. "Same thing you'll be able to do in about 20 years or so," I said, pulling my keys out of my pocket and carefully laying them down on top of my jeans.
"You mean get naked? I can do that now."
"Wow," she sniggered.
"You need to get some sun."
"Shut up, I'm Irish." I drew power from the earth through my tattoos and enjoyed Granuelle's gasp of astonishment as I turned into a great horned owl. I snapped up my key ring in my beak before launching myself into the sky on silent wings.
"Show off!"
Gunner called after me. He was just jealous. People don't gasp appreciatively when he changes form in front of them. They scream. It was less than a minute's flight, as the owl flies, to my house from the widow's. The police sitting in the patrol car outside my house looked supremely bored. I spiraled down into my backyard for a landing and took a nice long look around before changing back into human form. My wards were still in place and no one was watching, so I grew myself some opposable thumbs and entered through my back door. The slip of paper with Radomiwa's blood on it was still locked up in my bookcase, precisely where I'd left it. I punched a hole through one corner and threaded it onto my key ring, then returned to my backyard. There I bound myself back to an owl, picked up the keys in my beak, and enjoyed the short flight back to the widow's house. Granuelle was seated in the lotus position inside a circle she had traced in the dirt, Fragara laying across her lap, cradled at either end by her hands. She was chanting something in Tamil, so I was fairly certain that Laksha was in charge. Gunnar Magnuson was still in human form, but his hackles were up, if you know what I mean. He looked mightily relieved to see me.
"How long has she been at it?"
I asked in a low voice once I had the use of my vocal cords again. My clothes were still laying where I'd left them, but I didn't feel especially anxious to put them back on yet. Switching forms so quickly left me feeling a bit twitchy and sensitive, and I didn't want the abrasion or confinement until I absolutely had to have it. The widow rarely came out to her backyard, and I could see no reason why she would with all of that fine beefcake parading before her.
"Only a couple of minutes,"
Magnuson grumbled, almost a whisper.
"But it feels like an eternity. That witch creeps me out, Atticus. Do you trust her?"
"No, I never trust witches," I said. "But I do trust her to do this job. It's an ego trip, or rather a professional pride sort of thing. If she can undo the cloak Radomiwa set on my sword, she proves she's better than Radomiwa."
"Do you need her to prove that, or is this just for her?"
"It's for me," I replied. "Radomiwa, not Emily, is the witch who's really holding Hal and Oberon. If we're going to take on her whole coven, we're going to need a serious witch of our own who's at least the equal of Radomiwa."
"Is that the entire point of this exercise? Didn't you want that cloak on there?"
I shook my head. "Not anymore. Yesterday Radomiwa proved that she still has a connection to this sword that she can use against me. She was able to show Angus Og how to bind Detective Fagles in such a way that he could sense the cloak, and thus see my sword, even through my camouflage spell. What if she could do more to the sword through that link? Turn it against me as I wield it, perhaps. I cannot take that risk."
"No, you can't,"
Magnuson agreed. "Besides, the entire reason I was cloaking it was to keep it hidden from Angus Og and his allies. Since he knows where I am now, and Briett told me she wants me to keep it, there's no more reason to hide. It's actually going to help having its magic in the open, Gunner, because that means Angus Og and the Coven will be focused on me and the threat I represent. They won't be worrying about you and the pack circling around behind them." Magnuson allowed himself a feral grin.
But they will know you're most likely coming, I continued. They would be stupid not to prepare themselves, so you, in turn, must be prepared. They will have silver, Gunner, guaranteed. The alpha male's grin melted into a snarl, and his features began to ripple as his eyes flashed bright yellow. Whoa, whoa, calm yourself. Now is not the time, my friend. I placed a steadying hand on his shoulder and continued to make reassuring noises until his face stopped running like hot wax and the lights in his eyes faded to their normal brown. I heard some howls and barking in the front yard, though. Not all the pack members had as much control as Gunner, and he had almost lost it as the Alpha.
I'm sorry, he gasped, short of breath and sweating. But we've been provoked past all endurance.
I know. But tell the ones who changed in the front to come back here and leave the widow alone.
It is done, he said.
Shortly thereafter, three agitated werewolves were circling the two of us, but studiously keeping their eyes lowered. I moved carefully to my clothes and started putting them on, explaining as I did so. The widow is going to need to see a familiar face at this point, I said, because she just watched three of your pack make the change, if I'm not mistaken.
That she did, Magnuson confirmed. Can she be trusted?
Absolutely, I replied. 2 days ago she watched me kill someone, and she offered me her backyard as a place to hide the body.
Truly?
Magnuson raised his eyebrows in surprise.
That's a fine woman.
The very finest. I grinned as I pulled on my pants and dropped my keys, along with the scrap of paper, into my pocket. But she's probably a bit scared right now. When the witch is finished... I nodded over to Laksha Granuail, still chanting away in a trance-like state. Ask her from me to step away from the sword and allow you to take possession by my request. If she refuses, send a wolf to let me know immediately, but do not attack her. Just keep her from leaving.
You want me to send a werewolf to bark at you like Lassie?
Magnuson looked outraged. Fine, come tell me yourself then. I rolled my eyes as I pulled on my shirt. Hopefully I'll be back in time to make the point moot. I sprinted around the side of the house to the front porch, where the widow was yelling at the remaining werewolves, including Dr. Snorri Yodersen, to get their damn spooky selves off her lawn. Mrs. McDonough, it's okay. They're perfectly safe.
Ah, Atticus, you're not one of them, are you?
The widow raised her arm in front of her throat. No, I assured her, I'm not.
Some of your friends turned into bloody big dogs right before me eyes.
She took a couple of deep breaths and clutched at the railing for support. I know. They won't hurt you, though.
Go on now,
she scolded me.
You're not going to tell me it's the drink talking.
No. What you saw was real, but it's okay.
Why? Are they Irish?
They're Icelandic, for the most part. The younger ones are Americans.
Wait. Wasn't Iceland a British colony?
No, it was a Nordic colony. Listen, Mrs. McDonough, I apologize, but I have some strange friends. None of them are British, though, and they won't hurt you.
I think you owe me an explanation, Atticus.
As a rule, I don't tell the truth about the world, because shattered illusions are no fun to clean up. But if the widow had a strong enough constitution to shoo werewolves off her lawn, I figured she could handle it. We sat down in her rockers as the remainder of the pack hurriedly cleaned up the trimmings and drifted one by one to the backyard, and I gave her the short version. There are more things under heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy, including druids like me and werewolves like the Tempe pack.
You're a real druid. Aren't you supposed to be dead?
Lots of people sure think so.
Well, if it's real, then there's no make-believe.
There's plenty of make-believe in the details. This vampire I know actually likes garlic quite a bit. And werewolves, as you just saw, can change any time. Though they do try to confine it to the full moons when they have to change, because it's a pretty painful transformation.
So, God really exists?
All the gods exist, or at least did exist at one time.
But I mean, Jesus and Mary and all that lot.
Sure, they existed. Still do. Nice people.
And Lucifer?
I've never personally met him, but I have no doubt he's around somewhere. Allah is doing his thing, too, and so are Buddha and Shiva and the Morrigan and so on. The point is, Mrs. McDonough, that the universe is exactly the size that your soul can encompass.
Some people live in extremely small worlds, and some live in a world of infinite possibility. You've just received some sensory input that suggests it's bigger than you previously thought. What are you going to do with that information? Will you deny it or embrace it? She grinned fondly.
Ah, my dear boy, how can I deny anything you say? If you haven't killed me yet for seeing more than I ought to, I figure you must like me, and you wouldn't steer an old widow wrong. And besides that, I saw those bloody werewolves with me own eyes.
I smiled at her and patted her hand, small and wrinkled and spotted with age. I do like you, Mrs. McDonough, quite a bit. I trust you and know that you're the really good sort of friend who would help me move a body, as your Sean would say. I know you must have a bushel of questions for me, but right now there's a crisis to deal with. Oberon's been kidnapped along with one of the werewolves, and that's why we're all so upset. We'll talk more tomorrow, and I promise to answer all your questions, if I survive the night, I said. The widow's eyebrows raised.
You've got all these nasty pooches to run around with you, and you still might die.
I'm going to go fight with a god, some demons, and a coven of witches who all want to kill me, I said. So it's a distinct possibility.
Are you going to kill him back?
I'd certainly like to.
Attaboy, the widow chuckled. Off you go, then. Kill every last one of the bastards, and call me in the morning.
An excellent suggestion, said Gunnar Magnusson,
coming around the corner and stepping onto the porch with Frogara in his hand. His pack followed him, both in human form and wolf, along with Granuail. Just by the way she carried herself, I could see she was still controlled by Lakshya. Radomiwa's cloak had most definitely been sloughed off. Fragara practically hummed with ancient Irish juju, and as I grasped the proffered hilt and felt the magic pulse through my forearm, I was reminded of its deadly purpose and of the deadly purpose I also had now. Right, I said, pulling the sword out and admiring its blade. I've waited long enough. If Angus Og wants this sword, then he can have it, for just as long as it takes me to eviscerate him. Chapter 22. The Haunted Canyon Trail Emily spoke of is in the Superstition Wilderness, which spans the infamous range of mountains where over 100 stupid people have died trying to find gold. Some of the most treacherous country anywhere. It's a rocky, thorny nightmare, spotted here and there with pleasant chaparral meadows. We drove east on US 60 out past Superior and took a left on Pinto Valley Road. That led us right to a copper mine, but a public access road through that property allowed us to get to the trailhead. This was the eastern edge of the Superstitions, little traveled and fairly remote. Most people went to the Peralta trailhead, where the hiking was a bit easier and the scenery more in keeping with their preconceived notions of what Arizona was supposed to be like. Majestic saguaros, ocotillo, horned toads, and Gila monsters. The eastern side of the Superstitions was less lush, high desert, and more chaparral, with little cactus beyond some prickly pear and several species of agave. Still, it did not lack for spiny obstacles. There was scrub oak, manzanita, and catclaw, chokeberry bushes, and whitethorn. But there were also cottonwood trees and sycamores, able to survive on the seasonal rains and flash-flooded washes winding through the canyon. Our caravan of cars arrived at the trailhead, and Gunnar had apparently told the pack they could let their wolves out as soon as they got there. The lot of them leapt out of their sports models and half tore off their clothes in their eagerness to let the rage inside them loose. Gunnar Magnusson changed as well, for we had spoken of our plans thoroughly on the ride over. Only Granuail and I were left standing on two legs, but Lakshya was in control and showed little curiosity at the spectacle of 20 werewolves changing in front of us. I beckoned her over to me. Let Granuail see this, will you? I said. I need to speak with her anyway before we go.
Very well, Lakshya said, and then her head lolled to one side for a moment as she went to wake Granuail.
The head snapped back up and Granuail smiled at me for a nanosecond before she registered the contorting, howling animals around us and said,
What the hell?
Shh, I said. You're safe, but I wanted you to see this. This is the Tempe Pack, and you've probably served most of them at one time or another at Rulabula.
Where are we, and what are we doing here?
I explained the situation briefly, and she was relieved to hear that Lakshya would soon have her chance at Radomiwa.
I'm going to put a couple of bindings on you now before we go, I said, because we're going to run through this country, not take a leisurely hike. I've been on this trail before. It climbs more than 1,000 feet in the first couple of miles, so I'm going to bind you to me so that you can draw on my energy, which I pull from the earth. That means basically you can run all night without getting tired. That's the first thing you'll be able to do once you get your tattoos. And the other thing I'm going to do for you is give you night vision, because the sun is setting. We're going to run behind the wolves, because you really don't want to be running in front of them when they're this angry. After a couple of miles, I'm going to have Laksha come back and do her thing, but I want you to have this experience. Grania Whale was a bit overwhelmed, and she confined herself to a nod and a meek little, okay. It was at this point that my cell phone rang. Wow, you get service out here? Grania Whale said. We're only 6 miles from the freeway. I didn't recognize the number, but I couldn't afford to ignore it.
Mr. O'Sullivan, said a familiar Polish accent, I have some important information for you.
It's sure to be a lie, Melina, I replied, because that's all I've heard from you up to now.
I never knowingly lied to you, Melina said. I believed everything I said to be true. It was only this afternoon that I found out that Radomiwa and Emily have made me seem to be a liar, that they have been plotting with Angus Oak and deliberately deceiving me and others. I have been lied to and manipulated just like you. I confronted them about it, but they refused to leave this foolish path they are on. So now our coven is split.
Split how?
There are 6 of them waiting for you in the Superstition Mountains. They have no doubt contacted you by now.
I pretended not to hear her last sentence. So where are the other 7?
We are currently at my home, and that is where we will stay while we consider what to do. We are forming a new coven, and we have much to discuss.
Which 6 are in the Superstitions?
That ungrateful snot Emily, and Radomiwa, of course, as well as Jadwiga, Ludmiwa, Mirosława, and Zidsława.
And the witches with you are?
Bogomiwa, Berta, Kazimira, Claudia, Roxana, and Baksława.
None of the names meant anything to me, but I filed them away for future reference. How do I know any of this is true? Melina huffed in exasperation.
I suppose I can prove nothing over the phone. However, when you confront my former sisters tonight, I trust you will note my absence.
It occurs to me that you would not be calling me if you expected me to die tonight. You're trying to prevent me from coming after you tomorrow.
No, I fully expect you to die.
Oh, how charming.
I simply didn't want you to think I betrayed you. Unlike my former sisters, I have a sense of honor.
We shall see, I said and hung up. I'd make a point of calling her tomorrow. I shucked off my shoes as the werewolves finished their changes and milled around impatiently, waiting for me to signal them to go. Have patience, please, I told them. I have a couple of bindings to do. I gave Grania Whale the bindings I had promised, then told the wolves we were ready. I had to stay in human form to carry the sword and communicate with Grania Whale. We're going to sprint, I told her. Go as fast as you can. Don't worry about pacing yourself. You won't run out of breath. Just make sure you don't twist an ankle. And with that, we were off, with nothing more than a couple of excited yips from the pack. Gunner had strictly forbidden howling and barks by prearrangement, in hopes of keeping our numbers and our distance hidden from Angus Oak and the witches. The werewolves could communicate via their pack link, anyway. Our enemies might have heard the painful cries of the pack turning wolf, but then again they might not have. Tony Cabin was a good 6 miles away, and the hill between us might have absorbed the sound. Something I was curious about was whether I could shield my mind from Oberon once we got in range. I'd never had any occasion to wish for such a thing before, but if he sensed me nearby, his tail would start to wag as sure as a princess waves in a parade, and that would alert our enemies to our proximity. I really didn't want to give them any warning if I could help it. After about a half mile of running uphill at a full sprint, across rocky, treacherous terrain on a moonless night, I heard Grania Whale giggle delightedly.
"This is unbelievable!" she crowed. "What a trip! Running with a pack of werewolves!"
"Remember this," I said, "when you get bogged down in your studies and wonder if it's all worth it. This is only a taste of what you'll be able to do."
"Will I be able to turn into an owl, too?"
"Perhaps.
You can take four different animal forms, but those are determined by a ritual and not by whim. Everyone has slightly different forms.
What are yours?
I can be an owl, wolfhound, otter, or stag. They're not forms I chose, but rather forms that chose me in the ritual.
Wow,
she said, suitably awed.
That's pretty fucking cool.
I laughed and agreed with her. We crested the hill, and by prearrangement with Gunner, we paused there at the entrance to Haunted Canyon. I had spoken with him extensively about our plans, because I could not communicate with him effectively when he was in wolf form. Communicating with Oberon was my magic, but communication amongst the pack was their magic. I was not part of the pack, no matter how friendly we were. And werewolves are, for the most part, immune to any magic that isn't theirs, even the benign sort that would allow me to talk to them mind to mind in wolf form. This, unfortunately, I said to Granuel, is where we need to part ways for some time. Laksha's going to need to rejoin us from here on out.
Oh, okay. Master or sensei or whatever. What should I call you?
I laughed. Archdruid would be the correct term, I suppose, I said. But that doesn't fall trippingly off the tongue, does it? And it would turn heads in public, and we don't want that. So let's stick with sensei.
Kick some ass, sensei.
She clasped her hands together, mantis style, and bowed to me. And when she rose back up, Laksha was in charge.
Why was she bowing to you?
She asked in her Tamil accent. I'm her sensei now.
I am not knowing this word.
It is an honorific we've settled on. Listen, we're 4 miles, give or take, from Tony Cavan. How close do you need to get to Radomiwa?
To take the necklace back, I'll need to be right next to her.
I mean, how close do you need to be to, you know, make karma happen? Do you need line of sight? She shook her head.
I need only this drop of blood I have heard about.
I pulled Radomiwa's note from my pocket and handed it to her. She examined it the way a normal human being would for a couple of moments, but then she pulled some creepy witch stuff and made Granuel's eyes roll back in their sockets, so all I saw was the whites of her eyes. I knew it was something akin to my fairy specs, the Vedic third eye that allowed them to see invisible traces of magic, but it was still creepy. When she had seen what she needed to see, her eyes rolled back down like slot machine tumblers to give me double pupils. They focused on me, and she said,
I can kill her from as far away as a mile with this, but I cannot kill the other witches without my necklace, unless you have their blood too.
No, I don't.
I was not thinking so. You will have to get me the necklace then, if you want me to be helping with them.
I'll probably be busy at that point, I said dryly, thinking of Angus Og. Suddenly I felt a tug at my feet, a subtle indication that someone nearby was drawing power from the earth. The only beings capable of doing that, besides me, were a few old-world dryads, Pan, and the Tuatha De Danann. Paranoia made me think of Angus Og immediately, since I doubted Pan would be chasing any dryads in the Superstition Mountains.
Someone's coming,
I said, drawing Froggoroth from its sheath. The werewolves' hackles rose and they spread themselves before me, facing the direction I was facing and straining with snout and ear to sense what I had sensed. Nice doggies. I wondered if the magic of the Tuatha De Danann would work on the werewolves. My own didn't seem to work very well, and it was the same as the Tuatha De's, albeit somewhat weaker. Laksha, I saw peripherally, had coiled Granuel's body into a defensive stance that was probably some form of Varma Kalai, an Indian martial art based on attacking pressure points. She wasn't dependent entirely on magic then, like most witches, for her offense and defense. Good to know. In case, you know, we weren't on the same side someday. The tug at my heels felt nearer. Whoever it was, they were definitely coming this way. I looked down the slope into Haunted Canyon, but could not spy anything moving. The choked overgrowth of scrub oak and manzanita along the trail had quite a bit to do with that. Someone determined to remain concealed could do so until they were practically on top of us. As it was almost certainly one of the Tuatha De Danann, they would have camouflage cast on them in any case. I saw a couple of werewolves snarl and leap slightly off to my left, and I shifted my stance to meet whatever threat might materialize there. The werewolves oddly tried to change course in midair, but apparently they could not avoid whatever alarmed them. Instead, they collided broadside with something that sent them whirling to the ground with dismayed whimpers. Werewolves, in my considerable experience, simply do not do that. The things that werewolves attack are usually the ones whimpering in dismay. shortly before they expire from an acute case of missing jugular. I expected Magnuson to completely lose his shit at this point and teach that thin air a lesson, or at least give his whimpering pack members a mental bitch slap. But he and the rest of the pack all flopped down, rolled over, and presented their throats to the air. Werewolves never do that. I was very glad I wasn't in hound form, and then understanding broke upon me as Flittish, goddess of the hunt, dispelled her invisibility and addressed me with a pack of submissive werewolves at her feet.
"Atticus, I must speak with you before you confront Angus Og," she said. "If you proceed as is, this magnificent pack will be destroyed."
Chapter 23. I was doubly resolved never to shapeshift around Flittish again. I had already experienced the danger before, but this object lesson positively cowed me. Her control over the animal form was absolute. I had not thought it possible to subdue a pack of werewolves through magic, but she had just made it look effortless. It provided me with a new perspective on our earlier encounter. My amulet had indeed saved me from the brunt of her power, where I had thought it had failed somehow, and Oberon had been as helpless to disobey her as Earth is helpless to remain dry in the presence of rain. "Flittish." I nodded to her and lowered my sword, but did not relax my grip. I could bring it up with a snap of the wrist if necessary. "What news?"
"The Coven of Witches with Angus Og is tasked with taking out the pack so that you arrive without help. They have rigged traps around the cabin with magical triggers that will deliver silver in several ways."
"Physical traps with magic triggers?" I said.
"Aye. And even were the pack to get past them, the witches all have silver daggers."
"Have you chosen sides, then?" I asked. The red-haired goddess gave me an enigmatic shrug.
"I will not fight for you or with you, nor will I walk the path you walk."
"Because you may not be seen to take sides against the Tuatha De Danann." One corner of her mouth quirked up, and she gave the barest of sardonic nods. No, Flittish would never be seen taking sides, but she could certainly give one side an intelligence bombshell on the sly. It was then I remembered she had sworn to be revenged upon Angus for interrupting her hunt in Papago Park. I was glad we had no quarrel. I think I would have had an arrow in my gob long ago. She had her bow and quiver with her now, I noticed. The protective rawhide strips on her left arm were new and fresh. "Might you have any suggestions for us as to how we should avoid those traps?" I asked. Laksha had stepped behind me and was trying to be inconspicuous. If she was hoping Flittish wouldn't notice her, it was too late. Flittish had already registered her presence and decided she was nothing to worry about.
"You can't avoid them," she said to me. "You'll have to trip one. But they've only set up a circular perimeter, thinking the pack will come from all directions."
"That's probably what they would have done."
"Aye. But if you attack one point and make a sacrifice, the rest will be able to get through. Then they'll have only the daggers to deal with, and whatever magic the witches can muster with werewolves at their throats."
"And I will have to deal with Angus Og."
"Aye. He's there. He's doing something in the fire pit, drawing large amounts of power."
"Great. And what of my hound and my lawyer?"
"They are fine, bound to a tree but otherwise unharmed."
"That is good news, thank you. But what about the pack here?" I said, gesturing to the werewolves lying passively on the ground. "What have you done to them?"
"I have subdued them, of course. They were agitated, and two of them leapt at me. We could hardly have a conversation while they were attacking me. And since you were doing nothing about it, I took the duty for myself."
"I have no power to subdue werewolves," I said, "and I would not use it even if I did."
"Oh?"
She raised her eyebrows.
"Then you are going to face an interesting situation when I leave, Druid."
"That's right," I said. "If they were agitated before, they'll be pissed beyond reason when you release them. They'll turn on me merely to vent their spleen."
"Vent their spleen. Are you trying to quote Master Shakespeare to me again?"
She smiled at me, and I began to think of things I really shouldn't before going into battle.
"Because no one in this age speaks of spleen venting."
"No, you're right," I said. "I get my idioms mixed up sometimes. It would be more contemporary to say they're going to go apeshit on my ass. So what would you suggest?"
"Communicate with them. explain what I did, and refocus them on their goal. They should vent, I mean, go apeshit, on the witch's asses, not yours.
I cannot do that, I said. I fall far short of your skills in these matters, Flittish. She frowned at me but said nothing. Then she considered the werewolves splayed on the ground, and I felt her draw a bit more power as she spoke to them through their pack-link. After about half a minute, the werewolves leapt to their feet as one and snarled at her. It became one long, threatening growl, and if I had that many burning eyes glowering at me, I'd probably have issues with a squirming colon. But Flittish appeared unconcerned. She said aloud,
"Go and free your second. If your sacrifice survives the witch's traps, I will render what aid I can to remove the silver. You are a strong pack. Fight well, feast well, and be whole again."
Gunnar Magnusson barked a last note of defiance before turning around and launching himself down the path into the canyon. His pack quickly followed, and I had no time to do anything except mutter a clipped, "Bye!" before taking off after them, Laksha close behind. The werewolves were not bothering to keep their pace down for the slow bipeds anymore. They quickly outran us, and Laksha and I were left running alone. Some of them, perhaps many of them, would be severely injured or even killed tonight to rescue one of their own. But for Gunnar and the rest of them, this wasn't about saving a pack member so much as saving face. No one could be allowed to mess with the pack and not suffer retribution, with perhaps the exception of Flittish. I was glad not all the Tuatha De Danann had her gifts. Clearly Angus Og did not, or he would not have given the coven the task of taking out the pack. He had other gifts, though, and I could only hope mine were a match. We ran in silence for a while, but by and by Laksha observed that Flittish's interference might turn out to be a good thing.
"I have never seen a pack so angry," she said. "It makes them stronger. They might survive the silver."
"Let's hope we all survive." We ran 6 minute miles over rough terrain in the unforgiving superstitions, so we approached the Tony cabin area in little over 20 minutes. We heard the werewolves ahead of us going apeshit on someone, and that's when Laksha pulled up and told me she would attack Radomiwa from where she stood. Her eyes were rolled up in her head again, and I wondered if Granuail would get a headache later.
"We are closer than we need to be now, and the werewolves could use my help. It will only be a few minutes."
I wasn't sure how she knew they needed her help. They sounded pissed off, but that didn't necessarily mean they required aid. "All right," I said. "I'll see you there." Laksha was already drawing a circle in the dirt.
"I am counting on it," she said.
I continued on in solitude. Tony Cabin isn't situated in a bowl, nor on a hill, but rather in the middle of a meadow graced by little beyond dried grasses and weeds. Around it, sycamores and scrub oaks, as well as mesquite and palo verde, provide ample cover for stalkers. There are a few trees near the cabin itself, including a couple of sycamores, and it was to these that Hal and Oberon were chained. Oberon had not yet realized I was near, and for that I was grateful and continued to shield my thoughts as best I could. I saw where the werewolves had set off the witch's trap. It was hard to miss because there was a werewolf moaning pitiably on the ground, with silver needles sticking out of him like S&M acupuncture. It was a bit difficult to tell for sure, but I thought it might be Dr. Snorri Yodersen's wolf, and I wondered how he had managed to draw the shortest straw. He wasn't at the bottom of the pack, but rather near the top, and as the pack's doctor in both human and wolf form, they could ill afford to lose him. I would never understand pack politics. There was a large fire pit giving off quite a bit of light in front of the cabin. But none of that light came from burning wood. It was orange and white and swirled around the pit in a torus like a hellish creamsicle. It lit up the meadow fairly well, so I paused in the darkness about 20 yards north of Snorri's prone form and scouted the scenario. The werewolves had already taken out 3 of the witches and dropped a 4th even as I watched, but they had taken some casualties as well. I saw 3 werewolves bleeding on the ground near the bodies of the witches. They were alive, but in very bad shape. The witches were awfully fast with those knives, perhaps using the speed spell that Melina had offered to use on me. There were only 2 witches left, Emily and Radomiwa. Melina and the other witches were nowhere in sight, which meant that she had been telling the truth on the phone. Radomiwa would indeed prove a challenge to the werewolves. She was chanting a spell from within a cage settled on the opposite side of the cabin from the prisoners, the bars of which were no doubt lined with silver.
the werewolves wouldn't be able to touch her. Emily, however, had no such protection, and I saw her Barbie doll eyes grow even wider than usual as she realized she was next up to become a chew toy. She was on the far side of the meadow, just visible between the sycamores next to the cabin, and she did not seem likely to stand her ground and die fighting like her sisters. Even as I thought this, she turned and ran into the woods, which would only encourage the werewolves to pursue her, frenzied as they were. But then I saw it was cleverness as much as cowardice. She would lead them out to the perimeter of traps, which was still active, and the werewolves would trigger it again. Gunner, whose wolf form was leading the chase, apparently realized this just in time, and he pulled up and commanded the pack to stop too. They stood and snarled at the darkness Emily had disappeared into, frustrated to be denied her flesh, but reluctant to leave the meadow when they were so close to freeing their packmate. It was time for me to act. There was nothing more they could do. I sincerely doubted they would be able to take on Angus Ogg and last long. I doubted I could.